You really want to be better with your finances. You try to put money away in savings. You look for deals. You wrote out a budget once a long time ago. You still overdraft from time to time and you still have debt. The truth is managing money is not easy, but Rocket Money can help. Rocket Money shows you exactly what you're spending every month. From there, the app helps you make a budget that meets your financial goals. The app even gives you real-time alerts when you're about to go over your budget so you don't spend too much. With Rocket Money, you can also see all your subscriptions at a glance and cancel the ones you don't want right from the app. Rocket Money can even try to get you a refund for some of the money wasted. Plus, you can use the Smart Savings feature to start putting more money away. Rocket Money analyzes your accounts to determine the optimal time to stow away cash without going over your budget. Our members report that the Rocket Money app saved more than $700 a year. Getting better with money doesn't have to be a pipe dream. Rocket Money can make it a reality. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel or download the app from the Apple App or Google Play Stores.
Coda just made riding the bus easier than ever. Now you can pay your Coda fare by tapping your smartphone, smartwatch, or card, just like you do at the coffee shop or grocery store. Love paying with smart card? Keep doing that. Have a pass? Still works perfectly. Want to tap your phone? Now you can do that too. It's just one more way to move your way with Coda. Get moving now with Tap to Pay. Learn more at coda.com/tap.
This has been bugging me all night.
Why?
So I finally get to get it off my chest today.
Am I in trouble?
Nope.
Oh.
How do the Washington Capitals...
It wouldn't matter anyway. So.
How do the Washington Capitals score 7 goals and Alex Ovechkin doesn't have any?
Well, I figured it was going to script, Darren, when the empty net occurred. I figured, well, that's there go. We're going to get to 887. And it didn't happen. And I think Protas, I actually think he was guilty. I think he felt bad with his hat trick goal. I think he went over to Ovechkin and apologized. I really do.
Would have.
Yeah. But there was a hat trick goal for, boy, is he a big guy. Oh my gosh. He's huge. Mm. Rather than Ovi getting another empty net goal.
I have an admission on Protas. I have to write his name down phonetically because if I try to read his first name the way it's actually spelled, my mind goes a million different directions.
Okay, so my version of that is?
Yeah.
Martin Natchez.
Oh, yeah. Long time it took me.
So because you and I came from a league where Stan Neskash. Mm-hmm. Played in the league, spelled exactly the same, Neskash. There are, if you listen to broadcasters or non-broadcasters, they don't know how to pronounce Natchez at all. So I have a trick. The moment I think I read his name or think that I'm going to say his name, I think of nachos.
Seriously?
Yes. And so I say, it's not Neskash, it's close to nachos, and then I say, yes, it's Natchez. And that's my trick in remembering Martin Natchez's name.
When I say, are you serious? Because I don't think nachos and Natchez are even close. I'm not sure how you get from one to the other.
The CH tells me that it should be. Mm-hmm. So as soon as I know that, then I know it's not Nickus. It's Natchez. So that's how I do it. Well, you just told me you wrote it out, you spelled it out phonetically for Protas.
Phonetically. Well, didn't
I? Well, that's what I do, and it's the phonetics of nachos versus Natchez.
And you know who has no idea how to say players' names?
Coaches. Everybody.
Coaches. You listen to press conferences all around the league, all 32 teams, and nobody says names right.
No, you're right. They're the worst, really. That's why they. That's why they've resorted to nicknames. That's why they've all resorted to nicknames. So,
you should get on board with that.
No, Nope, not doing it.
Fitzy's not coming up.
Who?
Fitzy.
Oh, Tom Fitzgerald. I see. I will resort to calling him Tommy at some point, but that's about it.
And I guarantee you I will get Doug McClain into this conversation one way or another, whether the conversation goes down that path or whether I have to force it. Because Fitzy played for Doug.
Tom did?
Yep, in the Florida Panthers.
I know, Doug. That was in my time at Hockey Night. Biggest man on PEI. We did a whole feed. We sent a reporter to PEI.
Did you?
We had cut out pictures of Doug McClain in a bar in Summerside. Oh yeah. Yeah. And then Doug tried to tell me one day about all the TV stuff that people did for him. Yeah, I know, Doug.
it was you. Me.
Yeah. Thanks, Doug. Okay.
Jeez. Just waiting for the light to come on to let us know that Tom Fitzgerald has checked in. But Boston Bruins beat Florida. I know he didn't play. Brad Marchand didn't play for Florida, but a bit of an emotional night at TD Garden.
Well, it's been 48 hours of emotion for Brad. Mm-hmm. To fly to Florida and then fly back on the team charter back to Boston. And by the way, the Boston Bruins are playing hard.
Yeah.
the Boston Bruins are trying to prove to people that
they can still get in.
Sure they can. How about the Zadorov-Bennett fight at the end? Holy smokes.
There was a couple this week.
There was 23 cities cheering. I'm not a big fight guy.
Yeah.
But that was, I mean, I must have gotten 10 texts from people saying, I'm thrilled that Sam Bennett was in a fight with Zadorov.
There was a fight in the Vegas-LA game the other night with Vegas down 3-0, and it turned the game around. And I had admitted on the air, and I'll admit now, I think it's so overrated, the influence of a fight in a game and on a game. And you may get your frustrations out, but I don't think it turns the tide nearly as much as people claim it does. But Nick Hag and Samuel Hellenius, that was a good go, and Vegas came back and made a game of it.
Momentum and emotion in the game of hockey are such a factor still.
Yeah.
Whether you like it or not.
You think fights can turn a game around?
No, I think emotion can. And like last night in Vancouver, Montreal won 3-2. First two periods, Vancouver wasn't even involved. First two periods, the Canucks were, you know, amateurs. That first line that Montreal has of Suzuki, Slavkovsky, and Caulfield was fantastic. They each scored a goal. At 3-0 in the second intermission, you're going, well, what is Vancouver going to show up? Well, Vancouver showed up in the third, almost tied it. And you could sense the confidence and emotion the Canucks had, particularly after the 3-2 Pedersen goal. And you went, man, they could come back and win this. And so the ebbs and flows of the game of hockey are still, and I know we talked to Brian Lawton about it with analytics. That's that puck luck and the emotional side of the game that people can't measure. And some teams get it and some people don't. And it's, to me, it's the most fun part of the game when you see comebacks and you see opportunities.
Like New Jersey last night.
I'll tell you, New Jersey last night looked like gangbusters the first period. Mm. And Columbus, who looked fantastic at the Garden on Sunday night, looked like they were playing street hockey. And then all of a sudden, two brilliant goals by the Blue Jackets, and there's another game. It was fantastic. It was a great game to watch.
Columbus needed a save last night. And don't take offense to this, Vancouver fans, when I say this. You're the most challenging team to be a fan of, the Canucks are, because you don't know what you're going to get one night to the next, and the team should be good.
That's and Darren Millard saying that.
The inconsistency there. Yeah, yeah. Send
Darren
me a note.
Millard.
Send me a note and tell me that I'm wrong. But it's so difficult to ride that wave. I actually understand why you're a little emotional at times, Vancouver Canucks fans. He's there. Tom Fitzgerald has saved me. We'll be back with the general manager.
You were going to get in trouble with Canucks fans.
I was.
Usually that's, Usually that's my job.
So. I'm sympathetic towards them.
Somebody on social media yesterday said, why is he always defending Jim Rutherford? Because he used to defend Jim Benning too. I don't defend anybody. I just try to speak the truth.
I know you don't defend me.
Well, nothing to defend.
Tom Fitzgerald of the New Jersey Devils. Talk about an emotional roller coaster that team and organization has been on very recently. It continues with 100% Hockey with Millard and Shannon. Welcome back to 100% Hockey with Millard and Shannon, joined by Tom Fitzgerald of the New Jersey Devils. And we're at that stage of the year, Tom, where there's the biggest games of the season, and you guys just cleared that hurdle last night. What was that response like from your team?
Well, I mean, it was a great response. It was a great start, probably one of our better start, if not our best start to a game. Like we had last night, a little puck luck as well, but you know what, you make your breaks and we created those chances. So it was nice getting off to a 3-0 start, got a little hairy there. And they shortly thereafter came back to make 3-2. But you know what, it just shows the resiliency of our group. You know, they know, you know, where the stakes are at right now. And, you know, no better way to really try to make a playoff push by playing playoff type games.
What do you make of the Eastern Conference race, Tommy? I mean, I guess it did have some effect last week on trade deadline, correct?
Well, it's so close. You know, when you look at the market and where people are at or teams are at and what they want to do, and, you know, there's more sellers than buyers. More buyers than sellers. You realize that teams aren't looking to give away their players because some momentum they have. They want to make a push for a wild card spot, and there seems to be more teams out east doing that than out west. But again, from my point of view, out east versus out west, it's probably the same out west. I just don't look at the Western standings. They're irrelevant for me. But it made for intriguing, you know, the last few days, you know, especially with some of the major injuries that we had to deal with.
What was the trade deadline like this year compared to the first time you went through it?
Personally. Pretty similar. Pretty similar, quite honestly. Yeah. There's a lot of anxiety. That's involved where you want it this year. We want to add, you know, we wanted to add certain pieces to the team, and you feel like you're at the 11th hour, the chairs get pulled out from underneath you and you come in second, in a lot of instances. And, you know, where the first one was, you know what, the plan was, we've got to rebuild. We've got to get assets. You have to sell off. I wanted to sell off all our UFAs. And when you have UFAs that you're possibly going to get stuck with, you know that's not good. You know, so there was some anxiety on the opposite end of getting rid of players versus trying to get players.
So Dougie Hamilton goes down. Jack Hughes goes down. Those last 4 or 5 days before the deadline, how would you describe your urgency to do something on Friday?
Don't forget about Jonas Siegenthaler, right, as well. Before that, you know, so those are three major pieces to, you know, the success we've had thus far. You can't replace them. You just can't. There's no replacing Jack Hughes. There's no replacing Dougie Hamilton's offense, and there's no replacing, you know, Jonas Siegenthaler's defensive prowess. So, but we wanted to add that left shot D, which we did with Brian Dumoulin, 2-time Stanley Cup champ, who we knew could come in and help, you know, solidify, you know, our top six. That was with Dougie in the lineup.
Those talks were a little longer in planning then?
Yeah, for sure. You know, and also look up a depth defenseman, you know, where Chalosky comes in. So our kids weren't forced to be put in the lineup. They could just gradually, you know, get their game in order. And but up front, you know what, we said it from the get go. We really wanted to kind of add to the middle of the ice, and we tried to do that, you know, right to the end. So you know, more, it wasn't just about this deadline. It was about, you know, adding a person whose contract, you know, would move into next year as well to add to our team. So unfortunately we didn't do that. You know, but we also were looking at depth pieces, and, you know, we end up, you know, going out and kind of seeing what the market was for certain depth pieces. And, you know, Cody Glass was a player that we knew could skate. You know, he's got great versatility. He can play up and down your lineup, and give us that depth. So that's kind of where we went. And obviously Sprong was a decision we made where this guy's had some success. He's definitely had success against the New Jersey Devils in the past, especially when he was in Washington a couple of years back. And, you know, we're trying to create more scoring from our bottom six. So, you know, trying to take on a flyer on him for us was a no-brainer.
When you lose the players that you did closing in on the deadline, do the buzzards start circling around you and the price go up? Can you see that happen?
I don't think that was the case. Listen, at the end of the day, we have a good team. You know, we have good players. We're missing now really good players, but doesn't mean we're not a good team. And I give the guys credit. We saw, you know, right after the deadline, you know, especially getting the win in Philadelphia and the win last night. I just felt it was my job to help them and add to the group in some way to help, you know, continue to get to where we want to go. And that's the playoffs. No, I really, like I said, I don't think the buzzards were out. I think that's just the market. The market was high and, you know, everybody paid a steep price for additions.
It's funny. Julian Breezeball went out and put two first round picks in a package to get two players. Do other managers keep track of those types of prices that then give an indication of what the prices will be on the Friday?
Well, everybody does their own business, right? But you know, I would say everybody's goal is someday give away a couple first round picks to add pieces that can get you over the top, really get you over the top with the foundation and pillars that you already have in place. And we feel we're going in that direction.
What's the value of a first round pick these days?
Yeah, you know what? It varies. You know, yeah. Everybody's going to have a protected first round pick, maybe a top 10, top 15. And then some just say, well, it's possibly the end of the first round, which are like second rounders anyway. So it really varies. But at the end of the day, they're assets. You know, they're assets to use to build to your future. They're assets to use to build for the now by giving away. So what's the actual value? I'm not really sure. Pretty steep, I guess, because teams are giving away first round picks and getting really good players to win now.
And the whole win now philosophy, that's certainly something the Devils are in now. It's a win now mentality.
Well, I mean, you've got to crawl before you walk, and you know, getting in the playoffs and being a consistent playoff contender is our goal. There's only one winner at the end of the day, and this is not an excuse. It's tough to win in this league. And you look at some of the teams that added, and you know, one or two of them won't get out of the first round because they're playing the other team that has given up so much to add to their team. So you know, we look at it in different windows. We've got a shorter window where, you know, guys, you know, certain pillars of our organization only have a couple more years, 2-3 years left. And then you have the long-term goals with our younger players who you control for much longer.
What were your expectations coming into this year then?
Oh, it's to be a playoff team, you know, and contend for a Stanley Cup. You know, if you're a playoff team, you can contend for a Stanley Cup, right? So that's, you know, our goal from the get-go when hiring Sheldon Keith was to build a team that could really sustain an 82-game schedule, you know, stay at the top part of the division, the top part of our conference, and be one of the best eight teams in the conference, and then take it from there. You know, so, you know, what we did last summer and what we try to add to that, we felt that those were pieces that would help us get to where we wanted to be, and that's to be a playoff contending team.
Yeah, and I wasn't being flippant when I asked that, but I'm just curious, does it change? Does it just want to get in and you're taking your chances there? Or do you legitimately think that you can win a Stanley Cup if you just get in?
I do. I think any team who gets in the playoffs has a chance, and we've seen that in the past. You know, St. Louis Blues just sneak in 2019. You know, we someone can debate that. Well, they underachieved up to that point, and they get in and they hit their stride. But I do think, just, you know, you get in the playoffs. Everything, you know, the stars have to align. Special teams have to be at the top. Your goaltending, you know, because your top players usually get neutralized 5-on-5. You know, who are the players underneath that are putting on the cape for that game or that series, and things just have to fall into place. And, you know, playing the right way can get you a long way. I mean, I played on a team in Florida that we didn't have any stars, but we played the right way. We had great goaltending and we had good special teams, and we had, you know, timely scoring by people who were supposed to score. And, you know, lo and behold, next thing you know, you're in the Stanley Cup Finals. So I think just getting in and you know, put yourself in a situation that you have a chance. That's all you want, is to have a chance.
Don't forget your head coach in Florida, because he tells us all the time how incredible he was, Doug McLean.
I'm sure he did. Yeah. I'm sure he did.
Those teams in Florida and Nashville, remember you were on the ground floor there. Mm-hmm. What did those experiences, how did they help you along the line of being a general manager?
A lot.
And a rebuild.
You know, yeah, and I considered David Poile a mentor because I felt I was an extension to the coaching staff and management, quite honestly. And but they were two completely different beasts. You know, you had I don't want to say a Vegas type mentality where, hey, we're going with veterans, we're going to push for a playoff spot, and as soon as we can do that. Where on the other end, it was, we're going to build through the draft, because that's how Nashville had the success, you know. That was the blueprint for Nashville, was built through the draft. This is how we're going to do it. It's going to be slow. We're going to do it the right way. We're not going to cut corners. We're not going to cheat. And, you know, those are areas that I feel both have helped me. You know, one, you know, your question, Darren, was, you know, how did this deadline versus my first one differentiate? And one, it was the same, like I said, but you know what? I want to build the right way, continue on the path that Ray Shero set, was let's not cut any corners. You know, this is where we are when we took over the team in 15, but this is how we're going to get to where we want to go through our experiences with expansion. And now as we get there, or feel like we are knocking on the door, now I feel like we can be a team that, you know, as we move forward, you know, are we an all-in team? And yeah, I want to be an all-in team. I want to be like the top teams. I want to give up picks to win now. So that's our goal. And we feel that we do have the players and the foundation and the pillars to do that moving forward.
Would you term it rebuild, what the Devils have gone through, or retool?
It was a rebuild.
Okay.
Yeah. Cause we, you know, when we got here, it was, the bones were bare. You know, at that time, and that's no slate to any player that was here, and moving off of players to get value back, and let's not kid ourselves. I mean, you hit the lottery twice. You know, we're just so fortunate, so lucky to be able to do that. To, I don't want to say accelerate it, but at least put you in a situation where you're building these pillars that then you can end up building around, like we're talking about right now, of being all in at deadlines and not selling off versus being buyers.
100% Hockey with John Shannon and Darren Millar continues with Tom Fitzgerald next. You mentioned Sheldon Keefe earlier, Tom, and John Shannon will be back in. I'm not hogging the whole thing. He just had a camera problem. You mentioned Sheldon. That's one major change from last year. Goaltending is the other. Did you have a priority on either, or was it you had to get both done?
Well, you know, after letting Lindy go last spring, getting a head coach was priority. Throughout the last season, you know, finding a goaltender who could stabilize our team and give us a chance to win games on a nightly basis was also a goal. You know, we started with Jake Allen. We felt he could help us, and we controlled him for the extra year. But going into the offseason, you know, the number one goal was to find that stabilizer in the blue paint. And we feel we got that. And we got both. You know, having Sheldon, very fortunate. He's so passionate, smart, you know, just a tactician of a coach, very organized, well-respected, and can really, has really pushed our guys to levels where I'm not sure they felt they could get to. And it's really helped. So yeah, you know, the offseason goals were to one, you know, add the quality coach and obviously the stabilizer in the net that can give us a chance to win hockey games on a nightly basis.
You go through an extensive interview process with prospective head coaches, so you know Sheldon Keefe by the end of it. Mm-hmm. What have you learned about him in the first three quarters of this season along the way?
He's extremely dialed in on every facet of coaching, and that's including player development. You know, when you look back at his his start, he was a development coach, you know, coaching in the American Hockey League, or even going back to his junior days, coaching juniors in the American Hockey League, your primary job is to develop hockey players and move them on to the next level. So, you know, how involved he is with our prospects that aren't in New Jersey has been really eye-opening, quite honestly, and how invested he is for the future of this organization and where guys are at. So, really just the messaging from New Jersey to Utica and to from him to our head coach, Ryan Perrant, down in Utica right now, and where guys should be at and, you know, what we should be doing and helping out. That's been really eye-opening. But like I said, he's all in, you know, when it comes to every facet of the organization. And that kind of, that caught me by surprise a bit, because, you know, usually coaches are just, all they care about is their team. And it was actually something I didn't expect.
Nice to have John Shannon back with us. Nobody fixes technical difficulties like a producer.
Nobody knows that there were technical difficulties until you said that, though. So,
well, I mentioned it earlier, though.
Yeah, but don't. Anyway, so Tommy, you talked about Albany and you talked about development of players. I got to ask you about Simon Nemich.
Yeah.
He's high pick. Played great in the Olympics. That's probably one of the reasons why you looked at him so seriously, and he just hasn't come around. Where do you see his development?
I disagree, John. Come around is I don't know. It's a statement that I say that he's a failure, and he's not. And when you look back, and you got to remember, he's still 20 years old.
Yep.
You know, he's going to be 21 at some point this year, but he's still a young pro. You know, last year when we had the injury to Dougie Hamilton, you know, Simone Nemich wasn't going to be coming up at all. You know, the CBA tells you like those 2-year slides, and that helps good teams because you got good players on your under contract that are still on the ELC. With Simon, though, it's been, you know, he's played 60-something games last year in the National Hockey League and then come in the camp. He had a bad injury, you know, with the Olympic qualifier with Slovakia back before Labor Day. And that put him behind the eight ball a bit, you know, conditioning-wise, you know, just his on-ice game. He came in the camp. It was just okay. Okay is just not good enough. And he lost his starting position. He was supposed to start. He's supposed to be one of the top six with to Kovacevic, but he still got to chance to play because the injuries to Luke Hughes and Pesci. And there were games he played very well. You know, I think the inconsistencies of young players is something you have to be patient with and let them ride it out. And but like Sheldon has said many times, it's not a development league, and we're at a stage in our, you know, at our organization that, you know what, we need to be ready. So, mm-hmm. But we believe in him. He's a good player. He's going to be a good player once he hits his prime.
Who's more patient, your management group or Simon? Because I get a sense that he gets pretty impatient about himself too, right?
Who's that?
Nemich. Nemich gets impatient with himself.
Listen, every young player gets impatient. I put myself back in the days with the New York Islanders and getting sent down by Bill Torrey and Al Arbor, and I was ready. But then I realized later on I wasn't ready. I wasn't ready because I was only playing a fourth line role at that time, and they had higher expectations for me, but they couldn't do it. You know, go down and play the power play. And that's the same with Simone. Listen, again, if I put myself in his gates and I've played 60 games and I'm in the American League, yeah, my attitude may have slipped a bit, and the American Hockey League is a hard league. You've got to be dialed in and focused, and it's more scrambly and stuff, and players think they have to get out and dominate. And I hate that word. I hate that word dominate because it means production to a lot of players versus go dominate at the net front. Go dominate at ending plays. Go dominate at making that, you know, first good pass, and let your skill set take over. That's kind of, you know, the message you send these young kids. But at the end of the day, they want to be in the NHL, especially with players who have actually been in the NHL for extensive time.
And the other young guy you have is Luke Hughes. And gosh, he just appears to be growing every day. Last night, he was spectacular.
Yeah, no, Luke, you know, again, he's a good young player. You know, he's still going to make mistakes, but he's learning from those mistakes. He's learning, you know, how to utilize the tools that he has, skating ability, stick, you know, using his body. And I'm just talking defending. You know, mm-hmm. he's getting better as a defender. You know, he's getting PK time and he's doing a hell of a job on it. So growing his overall game, and you know, let's go back to Sheldon. We talked about player development. Like you watch Luke Hughes' game develop right underneath our eyes because of the certain situations he's been given. But he's doing well at it, you know, and no one's ever going to give somebody, you know, more than they can chew off. You know, he's been great. You know, scored a huge goal last night for us. He's just growing every day.
For those that weren't in the building when Jack was hurt, it was an emotional couple of hours there for both Jack Eichel, Luke Hughes. Just physically, Jack's going to return. Mentally, how is Jack doing?
Better. I'd say he's doing better. I know he's doing better. He's come to, you know, peace with, you know, what's happened, and it's part of the game, and he's going to rehab and he's going to come back stronger than ever. And we're going to have a great player once he's back and healthy. And we're excited about that. And I think he's, you know, there was disappointment. There was probably, you feel bad for yourself. But at the end of the day, injuries happen in our game. And, you know, we're very lucky that, you know, he's going to heal and he's going to be back and he's going to help us, you know, achieve our goals moving forward.
He was one of those guys that showed some development at Four Nations. How do general managers develop at Four Nations? What did you learn out of what you were involved in?
Well, it was the best hockey any of those players have ever played in. It was the best hockey I've watched and the fastest games I've ever watched. I couldn't imagine playing in those games. And I think when you hear players talk about the speed, how fast it was versus anything else they've done. And we were talking about Stanley Cup champs, you know, and how hard those games are, especially in round four. I thought the experience was great for Jack, you know, understanding, you know, getting the time and space and moving pucks and what you can and cannot do. And, you know, he played the offside for most of the tournament, and that's a different position for him. He, you know, obviously plays the center ice position, but when, you know, in the past, he would play the left for whether it's injury reasons, you know, face-off reasons. But, you know, I thought he did well. I think it was a huge learning curve for him. But I will say once he came back, there was no letdown. Like, my God, he was still playing at Four Nations pace and everybody else was playing at the, you know, the American Hockey League pace out of the break.
What about you though? What about you, Tommy? What did you get out of it?
Well, I just think, you know, being around the people that I was surrounded with, you know, starting with Billy Guerin, Bill Zito, Chris Drury, you know, Chris Keller, our director of player personnel, it was fun to be around these guys and pick each other's brain and ask questions that maybe, you know, people wouldn't have thought of. You know, I think that's what good staffs do, is they push each other and they ask questions about players and personnel. And we did that. Being around the players, I mean, they're all great, great people. You know, I really enjoyed being around, you know, my family, with the Tkachuk family. And that was something I don't take lightly, you know. It's something that doesn't really happen all that often. And it was a lot of fun, but great people. You know, we came up short, but it wasn't from a lack of effort.
By the way, you talked about Jack playing at Four Nations level. Brady's playing at Four Nations level still. He's wired right now.
Yeah. He's playing good hockey. We'll see him in a couple of weeks. So hopefully he'll bring it down a bit.
Some people know, others may not, but your Big Walt's cousin, your cousins of Brady and Matthew. So what was your reaction when you saw what happened on that Saturday night in Montreal?
Surprised like everybody else, but I guess I shouldn't have been surprised with that. I just, you know, seeing these two, I don't want to say growing up in the shadow of their dad with USA Hockey because of the World Cup team in 96, because that's what, you know, that era of players remembers. Well, a little bit, you know, where, you know, our era was the 1980 team. So being around Mike Arizzioni and Rob McClanahan over those few days were just incredible for me. You know, I just think, you know, having that first shift and you're playing Canada and it was like, wow. But I can't believe it was, it was so smart. There wasn't two fights on one shift. So everybody got to stay in the game versus Billy Guerin and Keith back in 96.
Yeah. By the way, you talked about meeting Arizzioni and McClanahan. I was in Pittsburgh at the Hockey Hall of Fame, the U.S. Hockey Hall of Fame induction dinner. It was for Sam Rosen when he got the Lester Patrick. Mm-hmm. And I met Buzz Schneider. Now, I'm not even American, but to stand and meet Buzz Schneider, that was the coolest thing. I mean, those guys, and they're just folks now, right? They're just good old fashioned people.
Yeah, I mean, I've known Mike Arizzioni for quite some time. Jack O'Callaghan's actually a good friend of mine. I know Dave Silk. I met Rob McClanahan when we got together in Minnesota for the Four Nations tournament over the summer. But I was also at that dinner, and yeah. I also saw Buzz Schneider, and I also went right up to him and introduced myself.
Wasn't that cool?
I was 11 years old when they won that gold medal, and he was a big, probably because of the name, Buzz Schneider, like a character out of Toy Story, you know. But it was great to meet him. It was super, super nice. Gave me the time of day, and those are the players that I looked up to growing up. You know, when I was a young boy.
Yeah, so I worked with Herbie for 4 years on television. So as soon as I told Buzz that opened the floodgates to about 16 other stories about Herb Brooks. So it was,
I'm sure
it was a cool night to be part of. That was actually a really great night in Pittsburgh. There had to be 15 general managers in that room.
Well, there was a bunch of Pittsburgh Penguin general managers in that room that yeah, night with Jimmy right. and Craig Patrick. And EJ Ray. Was there. Ray was there. Yeah. Dubas, Kyle was there. You know, we got a table. I got a table and brought back all our Pittsburgh cronies. You know, Chuck Fletcher and Ray and Dan McKinnon, Patrick Alvin, Jason Botterill. We had the only one that wasn't there was Billy Guerin. He couldn't make it because of a function in Minnesota. But we had a great time.
That was the first time Jimmy had been back to Pittsburgh since he quit. First time he'd been back in the city.
Really?
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. So,
as a fan, Tom, what did you talk to Buzz about? Like, what were you interested in mentioning to him?
You know what? It was just more introducing myself and just saying how impactful that team was and these players were for my hockey career. You know, I wanted to be an Olympian. You know, at 11 and 12 years old, back in the Boston area, I wasn't thinking about being. Playing for the Boston Bruins. I wanted to play for my high school team. And then this whole Olympic thing came up. I was like, oh, imagine someday putting on the USA jersey. That would be awesome. So I've been fortunate. I've had both. I got to play for my hometown team and I've got to wear my country's colors. So, but that's what we talked about. And just, I kept it very short, very, very, very short. I'll tell you another quick story. You know, I went to the Commanders Eagles game in the conference finals and got field passes, went down on the field and walking around feeling, you know, like, oh, wow, this is great. Hey, there's Tom Brady, there's Gronk. And I'm like, oh, great. That's great. Terry Bradshaw, Howie Long walked by and I was like, oh, this is Howie Long. And I went right up to him. I had to introduce him because, you know, my family's from Charlestown, Mass, and Howie grew up in Charlestown before he moved out. So there's that connection and you know, that lore of Howie Long growing up and listening to the stories about his family. And I had to go introduce myself. And I was like a kid in a candy store, 56 years old. I was just in awe. like this is incredible. So yeah, you still get starstruck by the people who've actually made an impact in your life in a certain way. So yeah, it's a lot of fun.
I know you and Mary are close friends, but that was kind of the same type of thing when we watched him go on the ice the opening night of Four Nations, right? When he walked down the ice.
Oh, that was something. I'm not sure the Molson Center could have got any louder.
No.
That was incredible.
Yeah, it really was. Hey, back to the Devils.
Looking at your schedule, you have more home games and less road games than anybody else in the East. How do you manage to do that great scheduling that puts your team at home so much?
I'm just like Forrest Gump. I'm a goddamn genius, Gump. I didn't do anything.
But it's got to be a huge advantage, Tommy.
It is. I don't want to use it as a crutch either to say, oh, you know, this is great for us, because we've played well on the road. And, you know, once you get on the road and it's just focus on hockey, there's something said about that. But hey, listen, if we come out and play like we did last night for every home game and give it the chance to get a lead and win a hockey game, then I'll take it.
Yeah.
Can you
go ahead, Darren? Sorry.
I was just going to say, you mentioned resiliency at the front part of our conversation. Can you teach that? Or is that something that you just simply discover with a group along the way?
I think it's experience. I think when you can add players around the group who have gone through the ups and downs and, you know, trying to stay even keel during games, you know, the highs and lows, you're up 3-0. No, next thing you know, it's 3-2. And you're just like, all hell could just break out and you panic. And I think our younger players who have gone through this over the last few years, and I say our younger players are starting to become our most experienced players. Jesper Bratt and Nico Hischier, and obviously Jack Hughes when he was available. But I think you have to go through it to understand it and just become even keel. That, hey, don't get too high, don't get too low, and stay in the moment and just keep doing what you do well and stick to the game plan. And I think there's a lot to be said about experience and bringing in guys who've gone through that and who've, you know, the Andre Palats and now the Brian Dumoulins, you know, you look the Brendan Dillons, Steph Nason's been, you know, the resiliency that kid has had for his career alone, you know, up, down, in the minors, back up, you know. I think you have to go through it to understand it and to use it moving forward.
You mentioned the Commanders. So your ownership group is the same as the 76ers and the Commanders. Mm-hmm. How much sharing of information is there?
Quite a lot, quite honestly. You know, we huddle together once a year with all of HPSC's teams, you know, not only the Sixers and the Commanders now with us. You know, you got Joe Gibbs Racing, for example, and there's a lot to learn from there and how different that sport is. And Real Salt Lake and the MLS with David Blitzer and you know, the Guardians as well. So we try to, you know, our CEO, Tad Brown, does an incredible job of tying every team together and, you know, just bouncing things off. How do you do this? How do you do this? What happens when you do this? And it's been great for our organization. It's helped me grow as a manager to understand, like, you know, how different sports do things and, you know, just really, you know, having a growth mindset and wanting to continue to grow and get better is my goal. But having the resources that we have here at HPSC is incredible. And I'm very lucky that I'm part of this group.
Is there an example that you can give us about something that you've came across at those meetings?
Well, I think some, you know, when it comes to sports science, I think when you look at Joe Gibbs Racing and how they, you know, a millisecond is so important in winning or losing a race and how they work as a team. It's just, there's a lot of areas, quite honestly, a lot don't apply to hockey, but when you think about it, you know, you talk about, look at Joe Gibbs Racing and how they just the pit stops and coming in there and how they, everything was computerized and if we can get to this right here, this second, it's probably the same as, in a way, you know, trying to be a team that has a goals against average of this. If we can stay here, then we give ourselves a chance to win hockey games. And if our goals for this and our, you know, the whole, it's really the same thing. It's just different sports, especially teams. If you can have especially teams in the top five for both, then, you know, you're probably a good team. So, yeah, there's probably multiple things that you can use as an example, but to me, it's just listening to people speak and their experiences and understanding that, like, you know, sports are sports. And, you know, we're all competitive and we're all trying to find a competitive edge. And that's really what these meetings were all about.
What's your expectation of the manager's meeting next week? I mean, it's happening after the deadline now. It should happen before the deadline. You should be getting together.
Yeah, I mean, I'm interested. I've always, you know, I'm more experienced now. You know, it's, I think, my fifth or sixth one. But we put our thoughts towards agendas and just kind of, you know, what we can talk about and let the league finalize the agenda. And I haven't got it yet, that's for sure. So we'll see what's on it.
But you like where the game is right now?
I do. Of course. It's fast. It's physical. And there's still areas where I think we need to be more clearer, you know, with goalie interference. For me, like even some icing calls, like really, what is icing? Like, you know, you could be towards the end of a game and you get no icing waved off and it causes, you know, a team to lose or win. Those are areas where, again, the refs have the toughest job in the league. This game is so much faster than it was. And, you know, making decisions at the quick second, you know, at least with offside, you can look at the review and understand how they didn't call it. And then you can correct it with a, you know, we're going to challenge it. But you know what? It's great being around the rest of the managers, especially after the deadline. Mm-hmm. we enjoy ourselves together, and you know, the league puts on a nice show for us and just, you know, allows us to kind of let our hair down, no pun intended. Just have some fun.
And how are you with the challenges? When you're looking at a challenge, are you 80%? Are you above that?
I like to think I believe the offside challenges are, you should be 100%. Like if you're going to challenge, you should be. You've got enough angles to look at, or maybe 90%. You should be 90%. The goal interference, again, I'm not going to sit here and BS anyways. Yeah, I'm confused from one to another. And I feel for our video coaches who have to make these calls on a split second, you get 30 seconds. I like what Sheldon did the other day against Philadelphia. You know, they score, make it 2-1, and it was really, really, really close. And he called a timeout to give us more time to look at it, because that's what we need and realize, you know what? No, that his heel is just on the line. The puck is just over, to not challenge that. So, but at the end of the day, the video coaches and the Hawkeye guys on the coaches on Hawkeye, they have a tough job.
Yeah,
they've got a stressful job.
But I tell you,
if we can help educate them more, you know, I think that'll be you know, progression for our game.
The one thing we don't know is if they're gonna challenge an offside, there's a really good chance it's offside.
every team now,
that's worth its weight in gold.
Yeah, there's nothing 100%, but if I say there's anything closest to, it's offside. You have an idea.
And you like that system as opposed to, hey guys, it was only an inch. Come on, like give us a break. Do you want 100%? It has to be. You know what I'm talking about? People are saying, you know what, we're supposed to solve the egregious ones, not the minute ones, and take 5 minutes.
Well, I think if there is an offside, I think the refs are doing their jobs by not blowing the whistle down. Or just the flip side of that, if they blow the whistle down for an apparent offside, you're never going to know the result of that play, you know? So maybe more whistles should be blown for offside, and because you're never going to know what the result is anyways. You don't know if they're going to score a goal or because the play's over. So, and we'll see.
I always want to go back and check the one that doesn't go anywhere, that's just blown down, and go, was that really offside?
Yeah.
Because it was so close.
But we don't, right? But we don't.
Yeah. Never end up doing it. Jesper Bratt, just before we go, I think he's one of the greatest sixth-round picks of all time.
Especially in a seventh-round draft.
Yeah. Where's his ceiling at right now? A small player, but he's rambunctious. Not rambunctious, but tenacious.
Well, we're very lucky to have Jesper. He's at the level he's at for one reason only. He's a student of the game, and he's 100% dedicated to his craft. This guy is learning and pushing himself every single day. You know, he takes notes daily on where his game's at after games and where he wants to be. If he's not the hardest working guy I've ever been around, then he's up there top three. You know, we're extremely lucky. You know, the one thing that a stat that I saw last night, you talk about rambunctious, and I never thought I'd see this. He's one of two 70-point players or more that have 70 or more hits. Mm. I thought that was interesting from Jesper.
Well, I'll tell you what, lots of pressure on Bratt, lots of pressure on Heischer, lots of pressure on Meyer now that Jack Hughes is not in the lineup, and looks like you're pointed in the right direction, Tom.
Well, that's all we can ask for. We just, you know, go out and give your best effort, you know, follow directions, play a system, get to the areas where goals are actually scored, and you know, whatever happens, happens.
I'm normally a Nike guy, but I'm going to go out and buy some Skechers for Howie Long today.
Wow.
Thanks, Tom.
Awesome. See you guys.
Be good. Be good.
Bye.
Kind of going through the family tree with the Tkachuks and Chantel and now Fitzgerald.
Well, at least he's not from Brandon.
No, that is true. There's no Brandon or PEI connection with Fitzy.
How about the story about Howie Long? That's the magic of podcasting. Yeah. Get them thinking about stories in their life. That to me, that was the best part of the show. Yeah.
What was your biggest fan moment that you can remember?
I've had a few. It's a very Canadian thing. I mean, I did a lot of Canadian football, and I loved the BC Lions as a child. And my favorite football player was Joe Capp, who ended up going to Minnesota and playing for the Vikings. And then I was producing CFL football, and I met Joe Capp, who has now passed away, and he's one of the biggest dorks of all time. It was tremendously embarrassing that I adored this guy as a kid and then met him as an adult. There's so many people, you know. Gosh, the world we live in, Darren. Are you kidding me? I've got to work with some of the great people. I mean, Bobby Orr. I got to work with Bobby Orr. Mm-hmm. You know, he worked for Hockey Night for a while. One of my jobs, we did the thing called the Challenge Cup in 1979 at the Garden, and I wasn't producing it. But I, Ralph Mellamy asked me, he says, do me a favor. Can you do this job and this job? And then can you just look after Bobby? Yeah, sure. So it was Bobby and me in New York for 3 or 4 days. And we, after game one of the Challenge Cup, we're walking through the back of the Garden, and the Soviet players see Bobby Orr and recognize Bobby Orr, and they drag Bobby Orr into their dressing room after the game. So you have to understand one thing. After a game in those days, the Soviets did not shower. So everybody in the Russian room, Soviet room, sorry, is hugging Bobby Orr. So we finally get out of there, and he turns at me, and he is beet red. And he says to me, you're supposed to be looking after me. Don't ever do that again. Wasn't my fault the Soviets liked you, Bobby. It was one of those things that we, even to this day, when we see each other, we laugh about. So
you got Bobby Orr all stinky?
Yeah, that baby blue jacket was probably had to go to the dry cleaner between games one and two.
Yeah, you're right. Sometimes you shouldn't meet your heroes.
Well, who did you meet?
I was a Pete Peters fan when I was younger.
Oh, I love Pete.
I was a Philadelphia fan, and he came up and went to the final with the Philadelphia Flyers. And then I met him, and it just wasn't as dynamic as I was expecting.
Pete's just a low-key guy.
Low-key guy. But I did wait wait and wait after a game when he played for Washington for his autograph, because we knew the equipment manager of the Winnipeg Jets, Smokey Stouffer was his name. And we waited and waited, my dad and I and a couple of buddies, Pat Pink and Ryan Johnson, and we waited outside the room after the game for probably an hour for this autograph. We finally sent somebody in and said, can you find out if we got this autograph? Because Smokey was supposed to get it. And out comes a piece of popcorn, the cardboard, with Pete Peters' autograph on it. I'm like, this is amazing. So we drive from Winnipeg back to Brandon, and I turn on the light. My dad gets mad because it's at night. And I look at the spelling, and it's spelled wrong. Smokey had forged. Smokey had done the autograph, and he spelled Peters wrong.
1985, the summer of 1985, we decided to shoot features all summer, and I get and I assign myself, because I'm fascinated by Peters. I assign myself to shoot the feature on Pete Peters at his cottage just north.
Why
of
Why were you fascinated by him? Now, because you're the only
goaltenders. Okay. My favorite player as a kid was Eddie Jackman. So goaltenders were crazy. So we go to Pete's cottage north of Edmonton, and we go out on the sailboat, and he capsizes the boat.
Because he was showing off, or just?
Oh, he was probably showing up, but there was a big gust of wind, and boom, there we go. We're done. It didn't make the feature, though. It's okay. It didn't make the feature.
See that Sherwood stick right behind me?
Yeah, who's that? Pete Peters?
That was a game-used Pete Peters stick. Or is a game-used Pete Peters stick.
There you go.
It's about 400 pounds.
Yeah, it's pure, utter wood.
Pure, utter wood. That's a utter good wood. That's a good Finnish name.
Pure, utter wood.
Utter wood. That was fun today with Fitzy.
Yes, sir.
Did you like it that I didn't call him by his nickname?
Well, I
face to face.
I think you did while I was. I think you did while I was away.
So. No, I don't know Tom very well. I know him as a player and covered him as a player, but I don't know him as well as you. So I thought I'd keep it. And then I had to carry the interview for a while.
Tom is one of the great people of all time. Seriously, I mean, when he was with the Maple Leafs, I was working for the organization at the time. We used to laugh and have fun, and it was great. He's a good man, really is. I'm thrilled for his success.
Yeah. And once again, I had to carry your butt today. Do I get paid extra for that?
Yeah. Yeah.
Nice. Can't wait to see the next invoice. John, I got to fly. I'm really busy. I'll talk to you on Friday.
Sure.
Coda just made riding the bus easier than ever. Now you can pay your Coda fare by tapping your smartphone, smartwatch, or card, just like you do at the coffee shop or grocery store. Love paying with smart card? Keep doing that. Have a pass? Still works perfectly. Want to tap your phone? Now you can do that too. It's just one more way to move your way with Coda. Get moving now with Tap to Pay. Learn more at coda.com/tap.
There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit rightrug.com. RITERUG.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring.
Right here, right now.